1150 to 1250, when all of the early French cathedrals were built. That's a marvelous century, 1150 to 1250, 12th and 13th centuries. And it was during that period, actually, that the Arthurian romances came to flower. And I regard them as a European restructuring of this Oriental religion that was brought in from the Near East, namely Christianity, brought in by force during the time of the Roman occupation of Europe. The Christianization of Europe took place principally following Constantine in the 4th century. I think it was around 327 that he declared Christianity to be a permitted religion within the Roman Empire. He's followed immediately by Theodosius, who declares Christianity to be the only permitted religion in the Roman Empire. And not only Christianity, but the Christianity of Byzantium. This is the end of the 4th century. It's the period of Augustine, St. Augustine. And St. Augustine, a North African, was the principal statesman, of the theological position that was to be allowed. Rome had taken Britain around 50 BC, the part of Britain that is now England. Wales and even Cornwall were not particularly within the Roman province. The Scotland was not, and Ireland was not. Now in those domains, particularly Scotland, Wales, the Isle of Man, and Ireland, you had a continuation outside of the bounds of the Roman Empire of a very, very ancient tradition in the European realm. The two main structuring mythologies were first of the old Bronze Age, which is the ground mythology of all of the high cultures of the European and Asian worlds. And then around the 3rd millennium BC, the Indo-Europeans, who were herding and warrior people, came raiding in waves. It was these who were the Achaeans, the Greeks, the Dorians, and they came into Europe principally as the Celts. The Celtic tradition is of two main stages in Europe. The first is from about 1000 BC, and this is the period of the so-called Hallstatt culture. They had come in from around Bavaria. This is the sort of matrix area for the Indo-European coming into Northern Europe. And then around 500 BC comes the very brilliant chariot warrior period known as Latène, L-A, and then another word, T-E-N-E, Latène with a grave accent over the E, first E. This is the High Celtic period, and the main area is France and Switzerland, with extensions then in waves again into the British Isles. And these herding warrior people become the ruling caste, you might say, dominating the earlier Bronze Age, who were essentially agricultural people. It's important to realize that the principal deities of the earlier Bronze Age gave great stress to the female principle, the goddess, in all of her many modes. The Indo-Europeans coming in were largely of the male. Where you have a basically agricultural society, the goddess is the dominant figure usually. The power of women to give birth and nourishment is exactly the power of the earth itself. And so the magic of woman and the magic of earth support each other, so to say. And I don't think one can say that there was ever anything like a matriarchy, that is to say, a culture in Europe in which women ruled. But you have a very strong goddess mythology period where the figure of the goddess in her many modes is the prime figure of the mythology. The Indo-European people, on the other hand, were herding people, cattle herds, for the most part. And it was they who first mastered the horse. This gave them enormous striking power. And around 1800 BC, they invented the war chariot, which was the atom bomb of the period. I'm sure there were groups that were anti-war chariot meeting all over the world. But, I mean, when the power comes, it's there, and you can do all the talking you want. But they dominated then the whole field from Ireland to Japan. The war chariot appears in Northern Europe, it appears in Mycenae, in Greece, appears in Egypt, appears in Persia, India, and in China with the Shang Dynasty, 1523 BC. It's a very interesting weapon. The horse collar had not been invented at that time. The windpipe of the horse is out front. So when you put a band around the horse's chest and he's dragging a wagon behind him, he can choke. And so you've noticed in the Greek pictures of chariots, there's a very light vehicle with two powerful horses, and it holds a chariot driver and the champion. And that's it. Well, the Iliad has to do with all of this, and so forth and so on. Back there in that second millennium BC, it was the dominant form. And it goes into Europe. Now, there were, as I say, there were wave after wave of Indo-European invasions. And a very interesting story motif appears, which becomes the key story of the Arthurian romances, really. One of these warrior chieftains is scouting around, and he gets lost. Or he is lured into an area that he had never visited before. And in that area, there is a fairy hill. And the inhabitants of the fairy hill are, of course, the people of the goddess. They're living in the fairy hill. Now, Ireland is full of fairy hills. You can't see them. No one knows where they are. But it's full of these fairy hills, into which the earlier goddess people had retreated. And the typical story, then, is of this Celtic or Indo-European warrior coming to a hairy hill, going into it, and meeting the queen of the hill, Queen Maeve or somebody like that. Well, she's in trouble. There are people from another fairy hill that are attacking her, and this hero becomes her champion, and by virtue of his deeds, she is saved from the attacker, and he remains with her. You know the Wagner story of the Venus bear, the hill of Venus in which the hero goes. Well, the time that is experienced in these fairy hills is very different from the time that's experienced outside the fairy hill. So the hero is there, and after what he thinks are a couple of years, he says, I'd like your permission to go back home, see how things are. And she says, well, you're going to be surprised, and I advise you not to touch the ground. Just stay on your horse and pay your visit. Well, he leaves the fairy hill, and he finds that 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 years have passed, and nobody knows. There's a story about this man who disappeared, and that was he. And so what was simply a couple of weeks in the fairy hill, 100 years, you get this discontinuity. And it's the discontinuity between what might be called the world of our unconscious, which does not experience time the same way that our conscious life does. Well, this is the ground story. He will drop his glove or something by mistake and stoop over to pick it up and then disappear. You know, he just vanishes, just crumbles to ashes after all these years. Now, this becomes later a very a basic theme, actually, of many of the Arthurian romances. And the knight, particularly, who manages to visit one fairy hill after another, is usually Gawain. But when we get to the later period of the Middle Ages and the Arthurian romances, they're not fairy hills at all. They're castles, you see. And he goes from one castle to another where there's some lady in trouble. And so he is known as the Lady's Knight. I think Gawain probably is the sort of primal Arthurian knight adventurer. He's the nephew of King Arthur. Now, with respect to this Celtic mythology as it comes to us, well, perhaps we just let these people find a place to sit down. Come in and... Well, for those who've just come in, what I have had to say is principally concerned with distinguishing in the deep backgrounds, the old Stone Age backgrounds of the Arthurian romance, two culture strata. One, that of the old megalithic monuments, Stonehenge and all of that, which goes back to 3000 BC or so, and is associated largely with an agricultural and seafaring population for whom the goddess is the principal deity in her many forms. Then there comes into Europe in from, let's say, the middle of the 3rd millennium BC, wave after wave with increasing strength of Indo-European warrior people. The old Bronze Age people are basically agriculturalists, although there's fighting going on, there's always been fighting going on. But where you have the warrior people coming in, herding people, herders are typically are warriors because they're always encountering other herding tribes and they have to claim their property and so forth. We have, therefore, a collision or an interaction of two quite different mythologies. One, the mother goddess, and the other, the warrior gods. Thunder hurlers and so forth. Just by the way, at exactly the same period, the Semitic people from the Syro-Arabian desert are invading Mesopotamia and Canaan in the same way, warrior people with male gods. And this, in the Bible, of course, comes to an extreme where there's no goddess whatsoever. The goddess of the local people is known as the abomination. So you have a... I think the most extreme male-oriented mythology in the civilized world, the only one I can think of to compare with it, is that of the natives of Australia. The collision of these two mythologies, then, involve mother goddess systems and warriors. And the typical story, to repeat very briefly, is of a warrior adventurer who comes to a fairy hill, that is to say, a hill in which the mother goddess is the dominant presence. She is in trouble. He, through his heroic life and deeds, rescues her from the attacks and becomes her lover. And he remains with her for what he thinks are a few years, but they actually are hundreds and hundreds of years. And when he goes out to meet his friends again, they've all been dead for centuries, and the queen has warned him not to touch the ground, but by accident he touches it one way or another and just vanishes, disappears. So I'm saying that this is a basic theme that comes right down into the Arthurian romances, with Sir Gawain as the typical representative of a knight who goes not into a fairy mound, but into an isolated castle where the lady whose castle it is in trouble and he saves her and so forth and so on. Now, the Romans, as I've said already, conquered what is now England around 50 BC. And they did not leave England until about 450 AD, so they're there for 500 years. They constitute a very important presence. The people whom they are governing are of the old Bronze Age and Celtic stocks. And to repeat this, one of the stages of the Celts coming in, the first stages of the Hallstatt culture starting about 1000 BC, a rather with heavy wagons and slow migration into Europe from the Bavarian zone. And then around 500 BC, the brilliant Latène culture, L-A, and then another word, T-E-N-E, which is that of the great heroic chariot warrior period. The Romans come in, and we have what's known as a Gallo-Roman period. The Celtic Bronze Age people and the Romans. Writing is brought in at this time. Just read Caesar's Gallic Wars, book 6, where he describes the Celts and the Germanic tribes that he encountered. He gives us descriptions of their mythology and their way of life that is perfectly good anthropology. And it's out of that base that the idea of King Arthur first emerges. At that period, he's not a king. He is a god. There's a very interesting young scholar named Charles Musses, M-U-S-E-S, who until very recently was teaching at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He's now moved to France. But he discovered around the Lake Lucerne area in Switzerland no end of evidence of the presence of a god named Arthur. And you know, when there's a god named Arthur, then there may be people who are named after the god. And sometimes these two get mixed up. The person named Arthur and the god Arthur, the person then becomes thought of as a god and so forth and so on. And he shows that it's around the Lake Lucerne, this big lake, that many of the themes, the little particles of themes that pop up in the Arthurian romances can be identified in place. Now, the Arthur, Arcturus, Artemis, this is a name associated with the bear, a bear god. And the earliest deity worshipped in Europe almost certainly was the bear. And it's amazing how the word keeps turning up. Bayern, Bavaria, the bear. There's a city in Switzerland, Bern. And when you see the flags of the different provinces of Switzerland, the bear keeps turning up. Well, Arthur apparently was a personification of this ancient, ancient bear god of perhaps deep Paleolithic times, Bronze Age times, and the times of the Celts. So that's for stage number one of all this. The Romans take England. And at the time of Theodosius, the whole of the Roman Empire becomes Christianized. This is the end of the 4th century. Not only Christianized, but Christianized in the way of the Byzantine Christianity. For the first 3 centuries, there were many Christianities. And all those councils, Councils of Ephesus, Council of Jerusalem, Council of this, that, and the other, had to do with defining doctrine and saying these people are wrong and these people are right. So any bunch of bishops sitting around would really know, just because they all voted, that Jesus was really the Son of God, that's what he was. Well, this is a funny way of thinking that people, let's say, used to have. So there was a very, very strong dogmatic thrust here, and certain decisions were made, and it's the decisions are what we generally call Christianity. But there were other Christianities. There were a number of Gnostic Christianities. The word gnosis, if you were to translate it into Sanskrit, would be Bodhi. And a Gnostic would be a Buddha, one who had waked up and knew. Only in the 1945 period have we come back into possession of some of these Gnostic manuscripts. A big jar was dug up out of the Egyptian desert at Nag Hammadi in 1945. It's called the Nag Hammadi texts. And in it were found a lot of manuscripts from the 2nd century in Coptic, which have been translated out of Greek. And a totally different Christianity appears there. a Christianity that has to do not with the historical interpretation of symbols, but with the psychological interpretation of symbols. Let me just give an example. You know, we're all waiting for the end of the world. Some people think it's every 1,000 years people expect the end of the world. Told that when the year 1000 came around in Europe, many, many families gave their property to the church, hoping that they would gain merit. And then the world didn't end. And so there are suits in the French courts trying to get that property back. Well, now we're coming to the age 2000, and we've got fears of atom bombs and all kinds of things. So the end's coming, my friends. And I read the paper not very long ago advertising a big viewing stand that was built in Ohio somewhere, and you could buy tickets to see the end of the world. Well, Christianity actually was born out of one of those fervent fevers. And we read in Mark 13 Jesus' description of the end of the world. You know, it's going to be kind of tough on everybody, particularly those who are bearing children at that time. I don't know why they were picked out for this. But then the Christ would come in the clouds of glory, and everything would be, well, exciting for a while, but then perfectly beautiful forever. Now at the in these non-Hamadi texts, among the Coptic texts that were found the fifth gospel. The Gospel according to Thomas. It had been known for a long time that there was another Gospel. But here it is. In the Nag Hammadi, you can buy it now, translated very carefully by an excellent group of scholars, published by Harper, called The Gospel according to Thomas. And there, at the end of the Gospel, the disciples ask Christ, "When will the kingdom come?" And Christ answers, "The kingdom will not come by expectation. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it." So when you see the kingdom of the Father spread upon the earth, the world has ended for you as it was before. It's not just a place of exile. I mean, there's an imminent presence here. Now, against the historical interpretation of the end of the world, we have, in the European tradition, this psychological interpretation. That runs as a kind of underground stream. That's what comes up in the Arthurian romances, as I see it anyhow. Now, the characteristic of the European tradition from very early times is a strong accent upon and respect for the human individual. The Greeks saw themselves as altogether apart from and different from the Oriental and the ancient type of man. And this comes out spectacularly at Marathon and Thermopylae, where half a dozen Greeks held Greece against a horde of Persian slave troops. The Greek was not simply a subject of a king. He was the citizen of a city and was himself the director, you might say. The accent on the individual. And in the later European tradition, which is that which I'm talking about with the Arthurian romances, the individual is again strongly accented. So we have the beginning here in this Gnostic idea of certain people can have an individual experience that really sets them apart from everybody else. Here you have the idea of a popular Christianity and the idea then of an elite Christianity, which has nothing to do with money or anything of that kind, but with the opening of the inner eye and intuition so that you see the kingdom of the Father spread upon the earth. Now, it was in the Roman period, following Theodosius, let's say 5th century, that Christianity was brought in its Byzantine form into Europe, all others suppressed, and these Nag Hammadi texts buried at that time. They've now been dug up, so we learned something about the Christianities that were not allowed. Well, there's a very important European heretic named Pelagius. He was a Celt, possibly British, possibly Welsh, possibly Irish. He brought forth a couple of propositions that set the European against the Near Eastern Christian ideas. First one, you cannot inherit another person's sin. So what does that do to original sin? It's out. You cannot be saved by another's sacrifice. What does that do to the sacrifice of the cross? It's out. Each must save himself. Jesus may be taken as a model for your own, you know, imitatio Christi, own imitation of Christ. But what is the imitation of Christ? Going out and get yourself crucified? No. Opening your life to the spiritual dimension and live in and for the spirit rather than for economics, politics, and so forth and so on. And with that, you can open the eye. This is in the end of the 4th century while Augustine is condemning this very doctrine. You can see what the notion of an inheritance of sin means. It means you're not an individual. You are a cell or organ of a larger body. And when you study Christianity, as it comes down to us, we are members of the body of Christ and all that kind of thing, interpreted in terms of a certain group of people. But the Christ is the second person of the Blessed Trinity of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and of no certain individual group of people. It is that Bodhi, that Buddha consciousness, which dwells in us all. And what we're going to find when we turn to the Grail Romance is that the Grail hero, whether it is Percival or Galahad, is the incarnation of the Holy Spirit and equivalent to Christ. This is Europe claiming the Christian imagery for itself. So that's what we've come into here. The Arthurian romances are a statement of the European consciousness in the costume of a Christian tradition. But a number of the basic Christian thoughts are screened out. Now, around the year 1200, or pardon me for jumping back and forth, I'm trying to sum this up very briefly, as well as I can. Around the year 1200, there was an important abbot in Italy, Joachim, J-O-A-C-H-I-M, Joachim of Floris, or Joachim de Fiore. And he had a doctrine that he published of the three stages of the spirit following the fall in the garden. The first stage of the spirit is that of the Father and Israel. God, to recover from this disaster of somebody eating an apple in the garden, prepared a special race that would be a priestly race, and that would live in terms of spiritual interests and become thus prepared to become the vessel of the incarnation. This is Israel, the age of the Father. Second age, the age of the Son, the age of the Church, where this spiritual intention of God should become known to the world through the institution of the Church. Well, that's all very nice. So now we come to the third age of the Spirit, which is the age of the Holy Ghost, the Spirit, when the third person of the Blessed Trinity, the Holy Ghost, would speak directly to each individual. And, of course, that was heresy, because it meant that the institution of the Church would fade away, and so it was a doctrine that was condemned. But it caught on in Europe very strongly, and that is one of the inspirations of the Grail Romance, that the individual in his own individual life should become the vessel and vehicle of the Christ. Paul said, I live now not I, but Christ in me. Well, that's pretty good. In Buddhism, we know that we're all Buddha beings and just don't know about it. We live not in terms of our Buddha consciousness, but in terms of our temporal consciousness. The Grail hero is the one who should live in terms of his Buddha consciousness. So here this individual mystic tradition is in Europe, already stated in the Roman period by Pelagius, and restated then in the period of the Grail Romances by Joachim of Florus. Now to get back to the historical matter. By the 5th century A.D., Rome was in great trouble. It could not hold its lines against the German tribes, the pagan German tribes. Now, this is Christian Rome, against the pagan German tribes in the northeast. The Huns from Asia had come striking in from the east, and all of the Germanic tribal people were then pushed westward. They began bumping into each other, the Ostrogoths pushing against the Visigoths and the Vandals and all. And the Roman army was trying to hold its line along the Danube River and the Rhine. To shorten its lines, Rome withdrew from England. This left England like a clam with the shell removed. No defense. And the German tribes push right into England. The English people come in. The earlier people were known as British, and now the Anglo-Saxons and Jutes come in from around Denmark. Just think of the date around 450 AD, this collision between the native British and the invading English. The British kings were no match for these pagans from the mainland, the Anglo-Saxons. They were assisted in their battles by a man named Arthur. Now, he's not a king. This is very clear. There are chronicles that tell us about him. There's a chronicle by a man named Gildas, G-I-L-D-A-S, and another by a man named Nennius, N-E-N-N-I-U-S. And these are from the 6th and 7th centuries. And they tell us of this leader, this war leader, a Dux Bellorum, a leader of war, who was assisting the British kings. Now, most scholars interpret this as a native British soldier trained by the Roman military. Just as when I was in France as a student, there were a lot of Sudanese troops from the Sudan, which was a colony of France, and they had been trained by the French military, and so they were military warriors in the French mode. Similarly, here we have this British man trained by the Romans who is assisting the British kings in their fight to protect themselves from the invading English. That's the first step. So the man has the name Arthur, and we've learned already that Arthur was a god of the Celts in Switzerland and southern France. So the two things begin to run together. A man with divine powers. And we read already in Gildas and Nennius that he served magnificently in 12 battles, killing hundreds and hundreds of people. Well, nobody's going to do that. And 12 always tells you we're on a zodiac, you know? He's a sun god already. So much for the actual historic Arthur. Now, as always when invaders come in, there are refugees. And the refugees from southern Britain went to Brittany in France, that little peninsula that points out this way. And the people in Brittany began to talk about the day when Arthur would return and recover for them their land. And this is called the Hope of the Bretons. These are people in France who hoped that England would be wiped out and Britain restored, and Arthur would come back in a second coming. So between the 5th century A.D. and the 12th century A.D., these stories percolate in the area of Brittany, and they absorb Celtic stuff from Ireland, Wales, Scotland, and Cornwall. And it's this brew that is the ground base of our Arthurian tradition. The am I fairly clear here? So we have the old Celtic god of a people that had already conquered an earlier Bronze Age goddess-oriented people. We have the Roman conquest of Gaul and Britain. We have the survival of old Celtic material outside of the Roman domain, the survival in Scotland, Ireland, the Isle of Man, and Wales. Then we have the Christianization of that Roman Empire. However, in terms of a dogma, largely in the mode of St. Augustine, but undoubtedly Gnostic material as well. This other Christianity was there also. Then the Romans withdraw. We have this collision of people. The oral development of a lot of tales based on Celtic lore and historical recollections with the idea of Arthur's return. So where is Arthur meanwhile? Well, we hear of Arthur being carried off by three glorious Celtic queens after he's wounded, carried off to Avalon. Now, Avalon is a Celtic word for apples. The Isle of the Golden Apples, the Hesperides in the Western Lands, you see, which is a kind of fairy hill or fairy island, timeless. And there he rests with the promise of a return. Or he may be dwelling under one or another of those great burial mounds that one finds throughout the European land. Or he may be in the Antipodes, down at the South Pole, among the pygmies down there. All these various ideas. But here's the notion, and you recognize the second coming of Christ in this too. Arthur is going to return. You have this idea of the dissolution of life and the world as it is by someone who will bring about a luminous world. Now, when you translate that into mystical terminology, it is a savior is coming who's going to wake us up to our Buddha consciousness, you might say, to our Christ consciousness, to the knowledge of the kingdom of the Father that is spread upon the earth and men do not see it. Now, this is the background of the Arthurian stories. The first entry of all of this stuff into the literary tradition comes in 1136. A book written by a Welshman named Geoffrey of Monmouth, The History of the Kings of Britain. Now, this is the history of those people who were in Britain before the English came, the Kings of Britain. And the story is based actually on the model of Virgil's Aeneid. You remember the Greeks attacked Troy. Troy fell. And Aeneas escaped from Troy. He was a Trojan, and after a long journey, he comes to Italy and establishes Rome. So on that model, we have the story of Brut, B-R-U-T, after whom Britain is named. And Brut was a Trojan, and when Troy fell, he also, long trip, only a longer one than Aeneas, and he goes out through the gates of Hercules up to Britain and establishes the British line. Now, this History of the Kings of Britain of Geoffrey Monmouth is a very important book. It carried into literary life a whole mass of Celtic lore which had been only oral. And when you read it, you have some pleasant surprises. You find King Lear and his three daughters there. It's an old Celtic story, and it comes first to us through this. Shakespeare picks it up, and we have it in that magnificent tragedy of Lear. But the whole thing ends with the story of the invading Anglo-Saxons and the British kings and Arthur. Now, the story of Arthur, as it was developed in England, is as follows. That he was the protege of Merlin. Merlin is an old kind of druid master, a kind of guru. And he can appear either as an old man with a long beard or as a young boy. Now, that's an important motif that occurs in many, many mythologies. You see, childhood and age are eternal conditions. But between childhood and age, you have to live in a historically conditioned society. Midlife, you are doing the jobs of your society, whatever they may be, and these are all historically conditioned. So people in midlife are culture-bound. They are bound to their cultures. But the child, there's only one child in the world. It's the same darling little spontaneous bit of organisms. And age is bumping into the same problems all over the world. I mean, this mud god falls off and this headlight goes out and so there it goes. And looking across the great curve of a lifetime, we have infancy and old age looking across. And so the one who can guide in terms of transcendent rather than simply historical wisdom is either the old man or the child. So Merlin can appear in either way. Well, no one tells us why he got this idea, but he got the idea that this wonderful Arthur, who was to be his prodigy, should be born from a lady Egern. And his father should be Uther Pendragon, who inconveniently was not Egern's husband. Well, Egern's husband was off on crusade somewhere, and Merlin brings it about through his magic that Uther Pendragon should assume the form of Egern's husband. So he goes in and they have a night together, and the fruit of this is Arthur, who becomes then, as I say, the protege of Merlin with his great plan. Now, what is Merlin's plan, anyhow? Merlin's plan is for the establishment of a knightly, heroic, noble group, caste, you might say, or governing people in what up to that moment had been a wild pagan civilization. And the first part of the great texts, that there are hundreds of texts now that develop the story, he is interested in the political conquest, but then in the spiritual adventures that are to follow. Arthur marries Guinevere. And shortly after marrying Guinevere, he gets the idea of conquering Rome. So he gets an army together and sails for Rome. But on the way he hears that either his illegitimate son or his nephew, named Mordred, has seduced his wife, Guinevere.